This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Tom Edwards, standing in for Josh Fennett, who in his infinite wisdom has seen fit to shout himself hoarse and gone and mislaid his voice. Nonetheless, coming up today...
How do you create an architecture design book that's not just about architecture, art, design, but really about how that world makes us feel as humans? So how do we feel in a space?
We meet the new editor-at-large of Phaidon, Spencer Bailey, to find out what lies ahead for the publisher's winsome, design-minded titles. Plus...
Though the odd exhibitor had put on a show of colours with matching wild patterns in their wares, most of the brands adhered to the lines of Scandinavian design. Lots of wood and muted colours, functional yet elegant.
Our Stockholm correspondent brings us the best from her city's Design Week furniture and lighting fair. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Do stay tuned. International publisher Phaidon, known the world over for its glossy creative titles featuring everything from art and architecture to photography, fashion and film, welcomed a new editor-at-large last autumn. The man to fill the role is Colorado native journalist and editor Spencer Bailey, who caught his first break in publishing in his early 20s, quickly rising through the ranks, penning pieces for the likes of the New York Times Magazine and Bloomberg Businessweek. It was this editorial dexterity that landed him the job of editor-in-chief for the American design publication Surface, where he oversaw a radical expansion of its audience and a major redesign. Now, at Phaidon, he presides mainly over the architecture and design publications there. Monocle's contributor Marissa Masria-Katz met with Bailey last week in Manhattan's Chelsea neighbourhood to hear about his vision for Phaidon and how he plans on championing print in an era of digital dominance. Marissa began by asking him to describe his new role at the publisher.
So it's an interesting role because I wouldn't even say it's day-to-day. It's almost week-to-week. I'm receiving pitches quite frequently, just sort of unsolicited. My inbox is kind of its own slush pile. And I hear from architects and designers and artists. I'm also reaching out to people and going in and visiting different groups. You know, in the last week alone, I met with our food editor here in New York, and we talked a bunch of ideas from doing an architecture book around a particular town in the United States to doing a cookbook that engaged design in a compelling way. So it's kind of bouncing a lot of ideas back and forth. And the role itself is sort of two-pronged. I'm basically functioning as both a commissioning editor, where I help bring in and package books that then get presented to the publishers and in turn get edited in-house. And then I'm also bringing projects that I would see through from A to Z. And those are books that I'd probably do a couple a year and really focus on things that I'm particularly myself passionate about.
Which are?
I'm really interested in the link between emotion and architecture, art, and design. So thinking about how do you create an architecture design book that's not just about architecture, art, design, but really about how that world makes us feel as humans. So how do we feel in a space? And this might sound abstract, but the reality is design really does impact everything we see, feel, touch, and do. And I think the more people who can understand that and can understand the value of good design, the better. So if I were to like strip down what my real sort of agenda or dream to do at Phaidon is to basically simply communicate the value of good design to as broad an audience as possible. And to do that, I think emotion's a really interesting tool because my dad in Denver can appreciate it and not be an architecture nerd. And then I can have somebody who's got a PhD in architecture also enjoy it. So to find that balance, I think, is really interesting.
So, of course, everybody wants to know, you know, in today's world, is there still a place for print in the world of digital?
You're asking someone who is a former editor-in-chief of a magazine and also someone who has joined a book publisher. And yes, so I do think that there is a place for print. I think we all, in the world of speed and seeming efficiency and just, you know, fast digital content and clickbait and Facebook and techlash and whatever else you want to describe the current situation we're in, I do think that print has a really special place because it's tactile. It allows you to slow down and to turn inward and to pay attention to what's right in front of you and not the thing flashing on your screen. Sure, that's an answer that's probably been told to Monocle 100 times, but that's the reality. I think it's the ability to allow people to engage with whatever's right in front of them and not be distracted by the 20 flashing signs.
You know, I hear you, and I think everybody wants to sort of have an answer to this question and maybe look into their crystal ball. But, I mean, do you think a book is still the best way to tell a story?
Yes and no. I think it depends on the story and what you want to tell. I'm really interested in streaming video. And I think Fiden's starting to think about that and think about the realms that it could get into a streaming video. For example, food books are a very big deal with Fiden now and have really grown under the editors and Amelia as well, who's been involved in that department. And watching, you know, how a book can translate into video is interesting, or vice versa. I can also see a place where something that's like a streaming video could also in turn be turned into a book and exist as something. Like, imagine if your favorite Netflix show were turned into a coffee table book that showed you behind the scenes.
So who's still buying books? And in your opinion, do you think the demographic is getting any younger?
I can't speak to the demographic. I haven't sat down with the Fiden team and gone over all the numbers. What I do know, based on what's been told to me, is that the architecture and design books at Fiden continue to grow year over year, and in fact have been one of the fastest, if not the fastest growing category at the company. So in terms of architecture and design books, which is really where my focus is, I think there's actually a lot of interest right now, because similar to how people used to care a lot about where their food came from in the sort of post-fast food generation of understanding, wow, we actually aren't feeling all that great. And I think the homogenization of design is having that impact on us, how our built world and the cities around us are impacting us. So it's the sort of idea of paying more attention to what's around us. And so I do think, in a way, people are becoming more attuned and knowledgeable about design, and that in turn is also making design something that's more accessible and not just like left to the academics or the universities or navel-gazing smart urbanites.
So Fiden's bread and butter division is architecture and design, and I think it's important to ask, you know, what do you think a well-designed compendium can do better than an online bank of images, for example?
I guess I'd return to sort of my answer about why print still matters. I think that ability for something to be on a printed page in beautiful color, really high quality ink, you react to the image differently than you would react to the image of the screen. It almost feels somehow more real, more as if you're there. Whereas I think, you know, the scrolling of images that we've experienced on social media, or even if you go onto a Pinterest board, it's a different experience of interacting with something visual. So I think that experience of turning the page, of paying attention to the details of an image, you look more deeply when it's on a page than you would on a screen.
Do you think that the younger generations will have that relationship to tactile things in the way that, say, our generation does?
Yeah, and I think it's changing very quickly. I think what's happening is that these younger people are realizing that they're having a lot of problems in terms of human connection and understanding each other and just feeling like they can connect somehow not only to each other but to the world. And so in a way, yes, I think that books provide that kind of connection that seems somehow more real than flicking through Instagram for an hour. Like, if you spend an hour with a book, it's a very different engagement. So I do think that there's going to be younger people paying attention to books. That said, and I think Fiden's been really smart in this approach, you have to both combine the sort of digital realm, get people to pay attention to what you are producing. You can't expect young people to walk into Barnes & Noble and go buy a book. they're going to engage with some element of it online and then be like, oh, I want to go buy that thing.
Do you worry, though, about the notion that people's attention spans are getting shorter? I mean, you just touched on that, but I think it's important to think about it as just this past week we had places like BuzzFeed, which are geared towards short attention spans, suffering from setbacks in terms of staffing. And so I think I would love to hear your thoughts on, you know, attention spans and your role as editor at Fiden.
Well, I don't think Fiden and BuzzFeed are going to be collaborating on ebooks soon. I won't say never. I'm just saying I would be surprised to see that happen. That said, you know, I think it's a totally different mindset. BuzzFeed wants mass. I think what we're increasingly going to see are more niche publications and publishers, whether it's in print or digital, coming about. I mean, just platforms, period, entities, people putting out podcasts, newsletters, that sort of thing. I think the approach to what it means to be a media platform in 2019 is very different from what it was even in 2018 or 2017 and how we're thinking about all these things. I think Fiden has this legacy and people really know and respect and appreciate it as a high quality content platform, which is really what it is. It happens to specialize in beautifully printed and produced books. I don't know if this is necessarily answering your question directly, but I do think that even in the age of BuzzFeed and Facebook, you can find a way to connect deeply and encourage young people to connect deeply when they're paying attention to what it means to have quality content. And so again, I think it's about literacy and education, almost similar to go back to that food metaphor. People started to understand the importance of where their food comes from. And now I think people are also understanding we're not just eating with our mouths, we're eating with our eyes. And how that makes us feel in our brain and in our heart and the result of what comes out of that. If we consume good content that's made from a good place and has quality fact-checking and good writing and good editing and beautiful photography, it's going to make us feel very differently than scrolling through 10 things you didn't know about X on BuzzFeed.
Well, okay, I'm curious then, how do you think technology has changed the world of publishing?
I think the publisher's going to have a better answer than me on that. You know, I'm just thinking specifically book publishing. But when it comes to magazine publishing or even looking at a entity like the New York Times, I think what we're seeing is that not only do individual journalists have to be Swiss Army knives, organizations themselves have to be, and they have to be very nimble. You know, there's a lot of what I call cruise ship companies. These are the large publishing houses we all can name. And they have a much harder time turning left or right than a smaller entity. And so I think that it's sort of an interesting moment where a big entity is really going to have to shift through lots of small moves, whereas the smaller entities have to really focus on what they do best and keep doing that. I don't know if that's necessarily clear, but I do think that that's what's happening, is that the big companies, in order to stay alive, have to make lots of little pivots, and the small companies have to stay focused and make sharp turns.
You're a proponent of slow design and slow media, and I think it's important to hear what exactly those ideas are. And I think in today's world, we're still prioritizing more and faster. And I'm curious how taking a slower approach can also be a successful strategy.
Yeah, I mean, slow does not mean inefficient. There's a book that came out, Oxford University Press, this woman, Jennifer Roch, published last fall, and it's called Slow Media. And in it, she talks about this idea of right-sizing. And right-sizing is basically about going at the right pace for the right task and not rushing things just because you have to get something out the door. And so, yes, in the world we live in, it's very difficult to sort of balance these things. And one can come across, I think, quite pretentious talking about this sort of slow thing in a world of deep inequality and a lot of these other issues. I think the real positive and the thing that's really interesting about talking about something like slow design or slow media and thinking about design and media like we think about our food is that food provides this really easy to grasp metaphor. It's not a direct corollary. There's a lot of things about making that corollary that don't actually add up and make sense. But I do think that when you really dig into it and you don't oversimplify it, there's a lot to be learned from what's happened from what was a seemingly esoteric group of farmers in the 80s creating slow food. Now it's a multi-billion dollar industry that's actually, you know, owned in part by Amazon, which bought Whole Foods. So I think that, yeah, there's conflicts and contradictions, but the fact that slow food became mainstream suggests to me that also this notion of slow design, things that are made thoughtfully with intent and with care for our planet, or slow media, the same equivalent, like media that's made thoughtfully with intent and with care for our planet, can happen. And it's about literacy and education and teaching people that in a sort of mass accessible way that doesn't seem pretentious, or you're not talking down to people. It's not prescriptive. It's something that you learn through really beautifully done content that engages you.
One of the things that you changed about Surface when you were at the helm was taking the position that design was something that you covered, and then it became the lens through which you saw the world. Do you think you'll take a similar approach to your work at Fiden? I mean, is it something you consider? And I'm only asking that because, you know, design is such an important part of what you support, designers and architects. So how do you take what you learned there and apply it to this new position?
Yeah, I think this would be a good example, thinking about a designer monograph. Like if you're a Design World magazine, you're going to just kind of cover product and not really tell the story behind the product. So I won't say who it is, but we've been discussing doing a monograph with a particular European designer. And the approach isn't your traditional monograph approach. In fact, what this particular designer wants to do, and I think it's a really great conceit in a way to cover someone's career arch or mid-career arch, is to, yes, look at what they've produced, but also do that by exploring who and how they produced it. So going and interviewing and meeting the craftspeople behind the product and actually sort of engaging the worlds inside the factories that make the things. So it's not just beautiful photography of finished product. It's actually telling a story from A to Z. So that's one example. Another is sort of this idea of emotion. It's not greenlit, but I'm really interested in light and shadow. And that's something I've been talking with Amelia and trying to figure out. How do you explore architecture through that lens? And Fiden's done that already in other books such as Brick, Concrete, looking at architecture through a specific material. I think those are interesting things because they're very narrow, but you can also go very deep. So it makes something that might seem not dull, but sort of basic, like a brick, all of a sudden really rich and interesting.
So 100 years from now, someone is looking back on all the publications that you've produced in particular design. What do you think they may glean from your tenure at Fiden?
I would hope that it's about, in some way, social consciousness and understanding how design intersects with everyday life. And connected, I guess, to what I said earlier, the idea that if more people in positions of power really understood the value of good design, then it would in turn, and this is an optimistic view, but it's my view, so I'll take it, make the world a better place. So I think that if someone were to look at what I did or worked on with the great team at Fiden, it would be that we produced a bunch of books that on some level communicated those things, on some level showed the power of design to make the world a better place. So not just put out a bunch of glossy architect and designer monographs, but rather show the value of design.
That was Fiden's new editor-at-large, Spencer Bailey, talking to Marissa Masria-Katz in New York last week. It's been a blustery winter across the globe, but snow wasn't the only thing hitting the streets of Stockholm last week. Thousands of visitors swooped in to attend the various events, showrooms and parties put on for the city's Design Week, despite the bitterly cold temperatures. The Stockholm Furniture and Light Fair is one such event, so our correspondent Liv Levichnik wrapped herself up in the warmest coat she has, and we sent her out to find out why that fair in particular had guests thinking about more than just the cold weather.
At the convention centre just outside the city, visitors to the Stockholm Furniture and Light Fair were strictly focused on finding the hottest products and emerging design talent from Scandinavia and abroad.
This is absolutely the most important fair for Nordic countries. The same way as the IMM is for in Cologne is for German design or Milan for Italian design. So this is the most important place for Scandinavian design, and that means that it's the only place you really can see it all. And every company who wants to have a presence in Scandinavia and also exporting, of course, is present here. And if they are not present here, they are present in the city and in some showroom of some kind. And because the market here is still good, we are still having a good economy, all of Scandinavia actually, unlike certain other countries. So there's a lot of companies coming here also who wants to take advantage of that. So there's a very, very high degree of Italians here and German companies and so on. More now than ever, I think. We also have Japanese companies here.
That's Eero Koivisto, architect, designer and partner at leading Swedish design firm Claesson Koivisto Rune. Koivisto attended the fair to network and show off his latest product for Swedisa, one of the many brands he's worked with over the years. This year, Koivisto saw a clear trend in furniture for offices and public spaces.
The workplace is changing a lot, so that also means that the furniture is changing also with it. I mean, of course, there will always be offices and there will always be workplaces, but I think it's not so specific anymore. You know, it's like before you sat down in a sofa and you looked at the TV in your wall and that was your images, or somebody rang you and you went to a room where you had a telephone and you lifted the telephone up and you had the news via printed things which were put in your mailbox in the morning. And now it's much more sort of fluid. And of course that affects all furniture also, because furniture is, you know, for humans to lie down or sit down or work on and so on. Right. So that means that all the furniture is getting more multi-use somehow, you know.
Koivisto also talked about the heavy presence of textile firms this year, many showing long flowing curtains and gorgeous carpets. And though the odd exhibitor had put on a show of colours with matching wild patterns in their wares, most of the brands adhered to the lines of Scandinavian design. Lots of wood and muted colours, functional yet elegant. But the fair had two sides to it. Stepping over into the greenhouse, where emerging designers and design schools from Sweden and around the world were camped out, the mood switched into rebellious territory. No one in the greenhouse was sticking to the rules, and instead showed playful takes on everyday furniture. Radically upcycled products from a gutsy design collective from Malmö, southern Sweden, and even an installation featuring design students dressed in pink in poses on the floor under the heading "Hurry up before we collapse." Not many of the more established brands managed to be quite so brave. The US brand Emeco was an exception, simply by showing its products in a no-frills booth. Belinda Ottobre of Emeco.
On our stand, we haven't used a floor, which we try to implement in every fair that we do where we can. And also all of the benches that you see on our stand today are used from an existing table series that we have called the Run Collection that we've reused in every fair that we have participated in the last year. And it was a design concept that came about one of our architects that we work with, David Sake, that decided to reuse existing materials so that the waste is completely reduced at the end of the fair. We don't need to put a flooring down to make the product look the way it looks. It's a very simplistic approach to design, and that is Emeco. The company is really wanting to do better at communicating the message across that we make sustainable products, yes, but we also are a sustainable company. Although it looks like it's just been put together, it's probably one of the more difficult ones to build because every detail is kind of looked at and scrutinised. And when we were putting our stand together, we can see how much waste goes into the stands that are building around us, and it's not the message that we want to send across with our company. It's getting the point across that sustainable, yes, it can be about how the product is made, but there's more to sustainability than just what it's made from. And for us, it's the important message that our Navy chair, celebrating its 75th anniversary this year, it has a 150-year guarantee. So the idea is that you never need to throw it out. It should be handed down from generation to generation.
And how do you stay in business then?
Good question. We reinvent our products. Obviously, the Navy chair is made to last, but we also would love to have the whole home fitted out, you know, with all the different collections. We only produce one new product, generally a year, and we focus heavily on that product. Eventually, we would love to be a world of circular economy, that you could take it back and make it into something new again, but reusing the existing materials would be an ideal scenario.
The Stockholm Fair, though small in comparison with many other furniture fairs, pulls above its weight in terms of the quality of the products on show. At the next edition, perhaps there ought to be a push for presenting them without all the superfluous packaging, and maybe save a little more on the resources that we hold so dear. For Monocle in Stockholm, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Thanks very much, Liv, and that's all we have time for today. But next week...
Then I started drawing, because I was invalid at home, I started drawing the house opposite. And she said, why don't you be an architect?
We'll be bringing you a long-form sit-down with an industry great, British architect and urban designer Sir Terry Farrell, the man behind London's iconic MI6 building and Charing Cross train station, among a host of others. He talks to us about finding his passion for architecture at a young age, what he'd do if he were mayor of London, and of course, the fate of postmodernism. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast, On Design Extra, available every Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, available on all good newsstands now. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by Christy Evans. I'm Tom Edwards. Josh Fennett will be back next week. Goodbye for now.